Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network. Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about another terrific podcast called Historically Thinking. It's hosted by Al Zambone, a historian, and every week Al talks to historians about how they do their work and about their books and about history in general. This is a wonderful podcast, and it's one of our favorites at the New Books Network, and I really encourage you to subscribe to Historically Thinking. You can go to historicallythinking.org and learn all about it. It's on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there. And we'd like to give you a little taste of Historically Thinking, so we're going to republish some of Al's terrific episodes, such as the one that follows. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast that's not only about the past and all its complexity, but also about how historians write history and how everyone can think about it. For more information about this or any episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can also sign up for our twice-a-month newsletter. Hello, my guest today is Bruce Clark, who writes on European affairs and religion for The Economist. He's the author most recently of Athens, City of Wisdom, which is the subject of our conversation today. Bruce Clark, welcome to Historically Thinking.
I'm very happy to be with you.
So one of the nicest questions that even ill-informed interviewers can ask is, what's your book about? What's your book about?
What's my book about? Well, my book is a long narrative history of one of the oldest continuously inhabited settlements in the world. And it tries to trace the story of Athens really from prehistory, from the semi-mythological period, right through to the present day. It includes, of course, the Golden Age of Athens, the 5th century BC. It includes the foundation of the modern Greek state, but it also includes periods that are fairly obscure, not much studied, the so-called Frankish period, even the Dark Ages. I do my best to reconstruct those obscure times.
I think we're going to, in the course of the conversation, we're going to focus on the obscure periods, the periods which are probably best known to Greeks, I think. We've talked about the Peloponnesian War and Herodotus and Thucydides in the past on this podcast. So I'm going to make the executive decision to completely skip over Periclean Athens and go to the very interesting dark corners of Indeed. Athenian history. First of all, it took me a while to realize that there are acropoli. There's an acropolis in many, many Greek cities. It's the geography of Greece that there's a high place. There's at the core of the town or the city is a high place, a defensible high place. So it's not to say it's very interesting. I think one of the key points is, however, when we say acropolis, we immediately think of the Athenian acropolis. You begin in a fascinating way with talking about what lies beneath the Acropolis. So talk about the caves and the wells of the Acropolis.
Indeed, absolutely. So, well, as you say, Acropolis is a generic term for a citadel, just as Kremlin or Kremlin in Russian is a generic term. There are lots of Acropolis, but one especially famous one, and it is an extraordinary geological formation with limestone at the top and sandstone underneath. The limestone is actually older than the sandstone, but it was somehow kind of washed upwards by various tectonic forces. And the limestone is both very hard, but ultimately porous to rainwater, to the slight acidic content of rainwater. And as a result, you know, there are a number of sort of schisms and fissures and indeed caves inside the Acropolis. And from the earliest times, people invested both the surface of the Acropolis and indeed the caves with great holiness. That's something that we forget. We think of the Acropolis as being a great sort of citadel of democracy. But in fact, it was and remained above all a holy place. And as you say, not just the surface, but also the caves. And now, now the two main gods that were venerated on the surface were, of course, Athena and Poseidon. But there are caves that are associated with Zeus, with Aphrodite, with Pan. So really, you know, the whole range of the Olympian gods were in one way or other venerated in those caves deep inside the Acropolis.
And going back to long before the foundation of what we of the classical city, these go into the Bronze Age.
Yes, we do know that sort of Athens was an impressive Mycenaean town. Now, most of what remains of Mycenaean Athens are the defences, but you know, people have done some artist reconstructions of what the Acropolis would have looked like in Mycenaean times, and you know, there was one of the many palaces, which were also a hive of economic activity. That's what we presume to be the case. We don't honestly know in much detail about Mycenaean Athens. But we do know that there was a spring of water that was in use in Mycenaean times. But only for a fairly short time, maybe for a few decades, and then some kind of landfall covered the water source over, so it ceased to serve that function. But that sort of vertical tunnel through the Acropolis did come into play in modern history rather dramatically, and I can tell you about that now or later as you prefer.
Well, I want to get to that. I want to put a pin in that and go back to that at the end of the podcast because it connects everything so beautifully in the history of Athens and the Acropolis. There's something very, I almost felt like I was becoming a Jungian reading the beginning of the book, because there's something very, there's the sort of the idea of these dark spaces beneath what we see as, we imagine as pure white palaces of reason. There's the underground, the dark, and then light above. But there's also, this connects to one of the most curious, I mean, there are a lot of curious foundation myths of cities in Greece, but King Erechtheus, the half snake first king of Athens, that connects very nicely to these holes in the ground. Can you talk about this very curious way in which the virgin goddess Athena had a son and is connected to Athens?
Yes. She is said to have raised Erechtheus, isn't she? And yes, there are a number of stories of sort of semi-mythological figures, whom the ancient Athenians perceived as historical figures, by the way, who were, you know, had sort of snaky tails. And one of them is Erechtheus, another is Cecrops, and the name of Erechtheus also has the variant Erichthonius, which sounds very like the Greek word kthon, which means, you know, home or soil, or and from which we get autochthonous. Having these sort of semi-mythological founder figures who had snaky tails, it was one of the ways in which the Athenians sort of understood their profound connection with the soil and the rocks of Athens. They didn't think they came from anywhere else. They thought they were, you know, that it was their place. Yeah.
I would go so far as to say there's a theology of place at the very heart of the Athenian conception of themselves.
Yes, indeed. Yes. That's right. Yes. Over time, King Erechtheus and Poseidon, the sea god, become fused. And so you have, the two most important temples on the Acropolis were the Parthenon, the temple of Athena, and the Erechtheion, a place that was physically smaller, more refined. It was also very significant in the cult of Athena, but it was said to be the site of the famous contest between Athena and Poseidon as to who would be the principal protector of Athens. Each was to bring forth some gift to the people of Athens. Poseidon brought forth gushing water, and Athena the olive tree, and she was the one who prevailed in the contest. So I suppose that was a way of understanding the Athenians' twin self-conception as an important maritime power, but also an important land-based power, and a power whose principal export was ultimately wisdom and cleverness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's very interesting too to think that Poseidon has multiple natures, and he is also the horse tamer. So if you're aristocratic Athenian, rides in Hippias, you're also dedicated, ways of dedicating yourself to Poseidon and his worship and his service, and ways in which he may or may not benefit you. But this is a small place. It's a small place. There are many other places that are as important or more important. And then along comes this crisis in which the figures of Hippias and Cleisthenes play an amazing, all of a sudden there's a world historical level of importance to what's going on in this small, out of the way place. Could you explain the revolution of Cleisthenes?
Cleisthenes is given credit for being really the originator of the Athenian democracy. Now, we don't, in all honesty, know that much about the person of Cleisthenes, but we do know about the system that was sort of more or less up and running from soon after the time that Cleisthenes was in control of Athens. Cleisthenes sort of came to power in the aftermath of the overthrow of the tyranny, which had been a dominating feature of Athenian life in the final part of the 6th century, first Pisistratus, then his sons Hippias and Hipparchus, and that tyranny is overthrown, and there's a question about what will replace that tyranny. Will it be a move towards aristocratic rule, towards the reinforcement of the power of the old families, or on the contrary, will power be broadened? Will the franchise be broadened? And under Cleisthenes, the second route was taken, there was a clear move to involve the lower classes of Athens in the governance of the city. And a whole set of institutions for which Athens became famous were instituted at least in an elementary form by Cleisthenes, and a whole set of principles as well, including the idea of equality before the law, isonomia, and the general ideal that institutions were very important, and that the city would be governed by institutions and rules, a constitution, as opposed to by the will of individuals.
And yet aristocracy remains amazingly important to the Athenians in ways that we can overlook. There's still a sense of many of the families that they're the ones that should be ruling. They might be ruling by being voted for, but you should vote for us because we're aristocrats.
This is true. Cleisthenes himself was of aristocratic blood. He carried the blood of the Alcmaeonids, who are kind of, you know, the par excellence aristocratic family of Athens, and as indeed did Pericles. You know, the Alcmaeonids are, you know, one of these clans who surface and resurface in the affairs of Athens, but interestingly, not always in the defense of aristocratic privilege. On the contrary, this is an example of well, what we might call now Tory democracy, or, you know, people of blue blood, who are perhaps so confident in their privileged status that they feel they can be the ones to extend the franchise and involve the poorer classes in the governance of the city.
I always think of like the Dukes of Devonshire and their connection to the Liberal Party. Manchester liberalism.
if you're familiar with 19th century British history, you'll know that sort of there was a moment when, you know, Benjamin Disraeli surprised everybody by broadening the franchise and, as in, you know, dishing the Whigs, it was called, because so he stole the Liberal clothes and opened the franchise to lower class people, and it, you know, it turned out to be quite a good political trick.
How do you rate the importance of this? There's been 100 years or more, speaking of Whigs, of seeing this as the means by which Cleisthenes or whoever, or Solon, if you wish, that they were able to unlock the energies of the people. And that what happens next, the war against Persia, could only happen if Athens was the sort of democracy that it had become. Is that just, that always strikes me as a little too Whiggish. What's your feeling about that?
Well, look, I mean, I suppose, you know, the fact is that the, you know, the institution of the Athenian democracy and the extraordinary triumphs over the Persians against all the odds, and they roughly coincided in time, and so, you know, they are linked in the collective memory. And look, you know, it's certainly there was a great energy in Athenian affairs, in the Athenian people, you know, around the time of the Battle of Marathon, the Battle of Salamis, you know, first on land, then on sea. The Athenians demonstrate their ability to defeat a Persian force with far superior numbers. And the fact that the whole citizenry is involved in this defeat appears to be an important factor. The fact that, you know, at Marathon, you know, many of the soldiers at Marathon were hoplites. They were yeoman farmers who'd paid for their own uniform, you know, their own heavy clanking uniform that they jogged down the beach in. I mean, this really was a citizen army. And certainly this was a period of great democratic energy. Of course, you know, things can be romanticized in retrospect, and I don't discount that factor. But if you compare it with, say, you know, the golden age of Thebes, which happened a century later, there was, you know, Thebes had been, you know, an authoritarian state, and there was, you know, a couple of golden decades in the mid fourth century when, you know, the power of ordinary citizens was unleashed, and, you know, to tremendous effect, and, you know, and Thebes became a dominant power for a short while as a result. So, exactly as you say, I mean, the trick in statecraft is to be able to unleash the energies of your citizens, while at the same time holding the polity together and stopping short of complete revolution. I mean, most ruling classes historically were very nervous of unleashing their people's energies. Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, historically, ruling classes were nervous of unleashing the energies of their people, because they felt that those energies will ultimately be unleashed against them, the ruling classes. And I suppose what you see in 5th century Athens is a very, very successful exercise in statecraft, where ever larger swathes of the population were somehow empowered and freed up to invest their energies in advancing the interests of Athens.
So we've got this then incredible moment where this small world backwater has led a league against the mightiest empire that probably the world has ever seen and pushed it back, kept it from pushing farther into their into the west. The Persians are on their, are at least on the, safely on the other side of the Aegean. And then Athens becomes the democratic center of an imperium, of a strange sort of imperial league. And then Peloponnesian War. Once again, we'll pass all over all that. Let's pass over to, I'm very curious. After the, you talked earlier about Athens becoming eventually famous for cleverness, and then exporting cleverness. So if we move on 500 years up to the time of the Romans, the Romans continue to see Athens as the center of cleverness. If you want to import cleverness, import it from Athens. Is that about
yes,
right?
Yes, I think you could broadly say that. I mean, some of the early Roman Empire emperors were absolutely infatuated with Athens. I mean, Augustus being one, Hadrian another. They had a Greek education either literally in Athens, or at any rate they'd had Greek tutors in Rome, and they were convinced that that Athens could provide the Roman Empire with the sophistication and the subtlety of thought that it needed. And indeed, under Hadrian, you had this idea that Athens could be actually revived and reinforced as the center of a sort of Greek commonwealth, but with a very important rider that it would stay absolutely loyal to the Roman Empire. It's a little bit like the British Commonwealth, I suppose. In a sense, it's the ghost of the ghost of an empire, which is held together by ceremonies, by rituals, by common memories, even by sporting events. That was the idea of the Greek Commonwealth, which centered in Athens, which Emperor Hadrian in particular wanted to found.
And I have to always rethink my conception of time when I'm dealing with this, because Hadrian's looking back to the time of Plato, Aristotle, and that's already 400 years before. It's like, it's like us looking back at Shakespeare.
It's 600 or 700 years before. Yes, so this is extraordinary.
600 or 700 years.
But nonetheless, there is a consensus that literature and thought and poetry, reached an extraordinary apogee in that fifth and fourth century period, and so people in the age of Hadrian were happy to look back on the literature of that time and see it as a kind of benchmark. And indeed, in Hadrian's time, there was this idea that the Greek speakers should actually cultivate the dialect of Attica and sort of reproduce as closely as possible the speech that would have been heard. It's as though we became obsessed with the age of Shakespeare and wanted in every possible respect to imitate the age of Shakespeare.
It's very interesting because it so clearly mirrors what will happen like around 1500 in Italy, where Latin as a living language is replaced with a sort of neoclassical Latin, a static language. It's very interesting that Hadrian in his, and likewise in a very similar enthusiasm for the learning of the past, he makes the choice to sort of attempts unsuccessfully to create this sort of static Greek. He's one of the first rebuilders of Athens. This is a continuous theme, given the age of the city, that he's creating the new Athens, on a slightly different site, but one which will employ the classical ruins and features that that exist.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And I think, and this process went on a remarkably long time through the Roman era, through right to the very, very end of the Roman era, even at a time when the empire was being ravaged by barbarian raids, and there had been devastating sort of barbarian raids on Athens itself. The idea of Athens as a center of philosophy, and the study of Plato is still very strong. You have in the fifth century, the extraordinary figure of Proclus, and we can talk about him if you like.
Yeah, please go ahead. I mean, this is the Neoplatonic thought of Porphyry and Proclus is tremendously important and overlooked in even survey classes. This is energy that will be given to Augustine of Hippo and many other people. These ideas that shape them and shape the next 1,000 years of philosophy.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it. I suppose, what we see in very late Roman Athens is a strong school of Neoplatonic philosophy. And it's important to qualify that by saying that, we think of ancient Greek philosophy as, supremely rational, and the idea of deliberation with, cold, calculating human reason about the ultimate nature of things. All that was there, but for the likes of Proclus, the great Neoplatonic teacher of the fifth century, his pursuit was as much religious and mystical as it was rationalist or philosophical. He was fascinated by the writings of Plato, his master, and he wrote very important commentaries on Plato. In his time, he would have been thought of as really a priest, a mystic, somebody who, through ceremonies and through rituals, was able to invoke the divine. The whole ethos of the philosophy of that time is that the divine is both elusive and accessible at the same time. The ultimate nature of the divine is something that human reason can't touch, but nonetheless, through certain ceremonies and rituals, we can experience the divine, and then wrestling with that paradox. How near and how far are we from the divine? And exactly as you say, that dilemma that God is both very near and very far, very accessible and very different, is also something common to the early Christian fathers of the church. So rather than thinking of a kind of a war, a perpetually raging war between late Platonism and Christianity, I actually was struck by the commonality between the two worlds, they are both struggling with how to get their heads around the fact that, from their point of view, God is both very close and very far away.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize, for the history of Athens, that there's this idea that maybe by 300, 400 AD, it's as if a car with a really big gas tank, and Socrates and Plato and Aristotle had filled it up, and it's been going for about 1,000 years. A little Homer, a little Plato, a little Aristotle, it will take you a long way. Eventually these schools, they're old, they're decaying, and they're running out of gas. But no. This is even at this moment, from 300, 400, 500, there's still creative energy coming out of the schools of Athens, and they're pushing forth ideas that will continue to drive things through the Renaissance with Platon and the rest of these curious characters in the middle of the 15th century.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's not, I suppose, look, there is a reading of history that would say that, a kind of Christian theocracy, suppressed independent thought, and it kind of, willfully suppressed the rationalist traditions of the ancient Greeks, to which we gratefully returned in modern times. But the fact is that, it is a historical fact that intellectual activity, did more or less come to an end in Athens in the first half of the sixth century. We don't know precisely when, but, by the end of the sixth century, it was over anyway. A lot of the legacy of the activity which had taken place in Athens passed to Constantinople. In Christian Byzantium, they were certainly studying the legacy of the Neoplatonist philosophers. It wasn't as though the Athenian legacy simply died. It just went to another place.
But the Athens has a very for the next 800 years. Athens is, it continues, but there is a little bit, it's no longer either a center of learning or a center of politics. Is that fair to say?
I think it is, yes. I mean, look, especially concerning the period from, say, 500 to 1,000, really the written sources about this period are very, very limited. Some empresses, Byzantine empresses, came from Athens. So in that sense, Athens is still producing remarkable figures, but they don't seem to have done much in Athens. You know, they become remarkable only when they arrive in the imperial capital. But then, you know, from 1,000 onwards, Athens is becoming quite important as a pilgrimage center. And that's something that, you know, most conventional wisdom ignores. But certainly for its last 200 years under Byzantine rule, the Parthenon becomes more and more important as a place which attracts worshippers ranging from emperors to ordinary folk to the cult of the so-called Panagia Athiniotissa, the All Holy One, the Virgin Mary of Athens. Now, what was the focus of the worship? We're not absolutely sure whether it was an icon or a mosaic, or was it the mystical light that was said to emanate from the Parthenon. But nonetheless, there was something about the Parthenon that drew people to it, and this building was strongly associated with the Virgin Mary. And in that sense, Athens was quite an important place, you know, certainly from the year 1000 onwards.
And so the Parthenon is the Church of Saint Mary, and for hundreds of years, even 1,000 years, that's what Greek speakers and Latin speakers thought of it as. And of course, there's also Dionysius the Areopagite and other figures in Athens that can be drawn upon. So I'm very curious. You have a nice section on medieval Athens, and one of my favorite medieval people. From the Accia, there's more vowels in this name than any even Italians really need. Acciaioli, I think Nereo Acciaioli. Can you explain Nereo and how he shows up and how he becomes the Duke of Athens, which of Midsummer's Night Dream, and the Knight's Tale, probably.
Yes. Well, I mean, the Duchy of Athens is a title associated with the so-called Frankish period in Athenian history, roughly from the beginning of the 1200s, when Constantinople falls to Frankish armies, and then shortly afterwards Athens does as well. In the case of Constantinople, it's only a half century or so of Frankish occupation. In the case of Athens, various West European rulers prevail in Athens for the next 200 years or so. Initially, aristocratic French families, they established the Duchy of Athens, whose sort of real location, whose capital is Thebes, but nonetheless it incorporates Athens as well. Then there's a period of control by Catalan mercenaries, of all things, Catalan soldiers.
Those are some tough SOBs. The free company of the free company of Catalan.
The Catalans left very little trace of their presence in Athens, except that I'm told that sort of into the 19th, earliest 20th century, there was an expression in colloquial Greek, "Ime Catalanos," I'm a Catalan, meaning I'm very angry. That does not survive in present day modern Greek, but apparently it did survive into modern times. The dynasty of the, now I would call them Acciaiuoli. Yes, I mean, of course, it's a tongue twister, isn't it? I mean, they came initially from Florence. They were kind of, Acciaio is the Italian for steel, isn't it? So They were sort of metallurgists in northern Italy. Then they became associated with the royal house of Naples, and they gained sort of high office in the court of Naples. And then, you know, they became, well, soldiers of fortune and opportunistic sort of landholders and conquerors in Greece. And yes, as you say, sort of, you know, Nerio Acciaiuoli, who died in 1394 as master of the Acropolis, was a colorful figure. I mean, he was, the Acciaiuoli were obviously a large extended family. And he was not even that closely related to the previous members of the family who had been active in Greece, but he was somehow adopted as the chief representative of the family in Greece. In a sense, what he's chiefly remembered for is his will, which heaped beneficence on the Parthenon, the Chiesa di Santa Maria, as he would have called it, you know, the Church of the. I mean, and if you look at his will, I mean, it tells you that it was already a very important place of worship, you know, with, you know, say, a dozen priests or so, and he's adding, you know, he wants sort of at least 20 priests to be saying masses for him. He wants to be buried there. And some silver has been taken from the doors of the Parthenon, and he wants to put it back. So he's hoping to save his soul posthumously by piling beneficence on the Parthenon as a church. And this includes, I mean, he literally, you know, Athens as a city, well, as a town, is really not much more than a straggling village. But he sort of, formally speaking, sort of bequeaths the entire sort of town, his holdings in the town of Athens, which seemed to be most of whatever the town of Athens was, to the Parthenon. And he also bequeaths his stud farms to the Parthenon. So it's, you know, he piles beneficence on this holy place, you know, in the hope perhaps of saving his soul.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm. Athens, as you said, is essentially an extended village, or a village living amongst the ruins of a city, like so many of, as Rome was in many ways. Town of 20,000, 40,000 amidst a city built for 1 million. Fast forward again. What's the next 200 years? There are continual wars between, well, every seemingly ethnicity in Eastern Europe has by 1300, 1400 ended up in Greece. Albanians, Vlachs, Bulgars, Serbs, they're all have showed up. Catalans, even, and Italians, Sicilians, and French. Everyone is in it seems like the entire genetic pool of Europe pours into Greece during the Middle Ages. And it's important to realize. But of course, the final arrivals, well, not the final, but the sort of the people who put their last stamp on Athens are the Ottomans. But that's relatively late, isn't it? The Venetians are still fighting in the 1600s with the Ottomans for possession of parts of Greece and for Athens.
First of all, one should say that sort of, certainly there were all manner of sort of conflicts and even legal arguments over Athens in the in the final years of the Frankish period, you know, in the early 1400s. But this was all taking place against a background of kind of broad Ottoman sort of, in the loosest sense, control over the region. You know, the Ottomans in those early decades of the 15th century were actually the regulators of the various disputes between Christian potentates as to who should prevail in Athens. And you see, you know, each party in these intra-Christian disputes sort of running to the Sultan or Sultan's representative and trying to curry favor with the Sultan. So, and then finally, after the conquest of Constantinople, you know, then, you know, it's the town of Athens to be taken over by Mehmed the Conqueror, who's depicted in one account as a great Philhellene and somebody who had great admiration for the legacy of ancient Greece. And the precise timings are disputed, but clearly by 1470, 1480, Athens was formally under Ottoman control, and it then would remain so until, to be precise, 1833 was actually when the last Ottoman government. After some colorful events during the Greek War of Independence.
Let's talk about the Greek War of Independence, because I know this is your favorite part. And this is one which I know lamentably little about. This is oddly enough, it's for English speakers, it's characterized by two lords, Elgin and Byron. Key players in the end of the Ottoman rule over Athens. So what did Lord Elgin really do?
We're talking about the kind of the twilight of Ottoman rule here, although it would not necessarily have been evident to anybody at the time that Ottoman rule over Athens was doomed to end. But nonetheless, things were very sort of intense in Athens because this overwhelming sort of Franco-British competition for influence in the East Mediterranean. You know, Athens became one of the many theaters of that competition, and indeed the antiquities of Athens were one of the objects in disputes, among the apples of discord, shall we say. So Lord Elgin, right? I mean, he was a Scotsman of immensely blue blood, not personally very rich until he married a somewhat younger lady who was one of the greatest heiresses in the kingdom, and so at the very end of the 18th century, he takes up his post as ambassador of Great Britain to the Porte, to the Sultan, with two purposes in mind. One is to reinforce the strategic alliance between Britain and the Ottomans against the French, but also to in some way or other, and initially it's not quite clear how, to bring the legacy and the magic of ancient Greece back from Greece itself to his own country. And for the past 50 years at least, there has been this obsessive idea among the elites of Western Europe that there is something magical about the heritage of ancient Greece, and if we can somehow bring it northwards, we will enhance our own empires, our own cities, we will endow them with the magic of ancient Greece. And this could take various forms. It could take the form of very careful drawing and mapping and painting of the antiquities, or ultimately it could take the form of physically removing objects. And you can see in Elgin's mind, there's a certain ambivalence from the very beginning. Is he in the business of documenting the antiquities, or does he actually want to physically remove them? Now, in the fateful year of 1801, the British and the Ottomans are jointly fighting the French in Egypt. With every passing month, the depth of the Anglo Ottoman relationship grows, and as a result, you know, the opportunities for Elgin's cultural activities, shall we say, you know, become even greater. Perhaps we shouldn't overstress Elgin himself. I mean, he was surrounded by some very energetic and ambitious people, including, you know, his wealthy wife, his parents-in-law, and a rather worldly clergyman who was his assistant, a young man called Philip Hunt. Between them, you know, these characters managed by the beginning of July 1801 to procure from a senior Ottoman official a document which, on the face of things, seemed to allow them to gather up stones, certain precious stones, qualche pietra di Petra. We only have it in Italian translation for some reason. But apparently from the ground of the Acropolis, from the surface, and perhaps below the surface, and that was the interpretation as of beginning of July 1801. Now, in the course of that fateful month, Philip Hunt, assistant to Elgin, saw that there was an opportunity, as he put it, to stretch or extend the meaning of that permit to allow a systematic removal of the sculptures that were actually still attached to the temples on the Acropolis, mostly the Parthenon, but also the Erechtheion. And so from the end of July 1801, for the following 2 years, you know, an enormous operation was in progress to literally strip the lion's share of the Periclean sculptures from the Acropolis monuments. And this included about half the Parthenon frieze, this extraordinary set of relief figures, 160 meters in length, which show a kind of procession of chariots and horses and basket bearers and men and women of Athens, a great depiction of the collective life or the collective imagination of the Athenians, conceived clearly as a single work of art. Elgin's people, Elgin's agents, managed to physically remove about half of that. And that half is now what's in the British Museum to this day. About whatever else Elgin may have done, he's associated in our collective memory more than anything else with the removal of those sculptures. And then, as you say, there's another figure who aristocrat raised in Scotland who enters the picture, who rides into Athens as an arrogant and brilliant young man, an immense gift for poetry, for an immensely sensitive ear for language, and eventually very, very keen powers of observation. This brilliant young man rides into Athens on Christmas Eve 1809. He spends the rest of the winter there. He then spends another winter there, 1810 to 1811, and absolutely falls in love with the place, and comes to a very different feeling about Athens than any of his predecessors, his previous sort of wealthy West European travelers had done. I mean, he had the impertinent then idea that Greece should be free. In other words, that the definition of Greece in modern times should be made by people who identify as Greek. It shouldn't be something that foreigners come in and impose on this place, but there should be a free state, peopled by Greeks, run by Greeks, who would go about the business of defining what Greekness meant and still means. And that was an extraordinary idea, which came to Byron and which made him a very sharp and acerbic critic of what Elgin had done.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, ultimately, I mean, it's really hard to convey Byron's persona. Here we have a celebrity poet, aristocrat, nationalist, freedom fighter. There's hardly anyone ever like him before or since. And he dies in the service of this Greek ideal.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he dies, you know, of disease, but nonetheless, he wouldn't have died had he not been sort of in a remote place in central Greece. So, yes, in an important sense, he gives his life for the Greek struggle. And he was also, I mean, he was a... He became a sort of a power broker in Greek affairs by the, you know, the Greek independence war broke out, you know, in 1821. In other words, sort of a decade or so after his initial kind of youthful encounter with Athens. But you know, Byron quickly emerges as somebody who negotiates with the various Greek warlords and chieftains, you know, many of whom are sort of in conflict with one another. Of course, you know, looking for British funding, looking for playing on Philhellenic sentiment among the British and other West Europeans. And, you know, Byron has the measure of these, you know, conflicting Greek warlords very well. He understands their psychology well. He understands their failings. He forgives their failings. He was, you know, he emerges as quite a shrewd power broker in Greek affairs, I think. Of course, he didn't live long enough to see, you know, the final victory. But, you know, I think it can validly be said that he gave his life for the Greek struggle. He was, you know, he found himself, you know, dying in a remote place, not of war wounds, but of disease. But now, it was a death that wouldn't have occurred. Had he not committed himself to the Greek struggle.
Just as we conclude, it's very interesting when Greece is finally liberated and the Ottomans are depart. Is there ever much of a question whether or not Athens will be the capital of a new Greece? And because if you look at it from a perspective of 1,000 years prior, well, actually, we're certainly 1,500 years prior, Spartans would say, you know, Mistras is nice. The Vale of Sparta is a great place to have a capital of Greece. The Thebans, obviously, they've got the problem of their backing the Persians after Thermopylae. But Thebes could be said to be much more the center of Greece. It's not evident from a classical perspective that Athens should necessarily be the capital of Greece. But my thought is that in the 1830s, there was no other contender really for that position, which is interesting, the way that Athens had become Greece and Greece had become Athens.
Well, interestingly, there was a year or two when it was proposed that Nauplion, in modern Greek pronunciation, Nafplion, that port in the Peloponnese, would make a better capital, simply because it had been functioning as the de facto capital of free Greece during the independence war, the question of where the capital would be did hang in the balance for a couple of years. I suppose, you know, I mean, Athens had the advantage that it could be, it could be a nodal point for the Peloponnese and for central Greece, each of which had constituted a separate theater of war during the independence struggle. The building up of Athens as the center of a Greek kingdom very much coincided with the advent of the monarchy, the Bavarian monarchy. Ultimately, you know, they found, you know, a spare princeling in young Otto, or Orthon in his Greek pronunciation, of Bavaria, along with his Bavarian advisors, you know, they set about intensively sort of reclassicizing Athens and remaking the, you know, half ruined town of Athens. In the very early years of Athens as capital, you have an extraordinary contrast between the, you know, frankly, you know, rather miserable settlement, which had been very, very badly damaged in war, of, you know, the lower town of Athens, and then the grand buildings that were decreed by the sort of Bavarian advised king, first and foremost his palace, a great barrack of a building designed, you know, by German hands in the very middle of Athens, now the Parliament building. You had from the very beginning a contrast between the sort of top-down design of the monarchy and the Bavarian advisors, and you know, and the Greek elite, shall we say, and then the more spontaneous emergence of Athens as a human settlement, which sort of somehow seemed to elude the plans of the designers somehow.
I wanted to finish up with just asking you about two things. You've written a previous book about an event which is sadly overlooked at the base of the expulsion of the of Greeks from Asia Minor during the Greek-Turkish War of, 1924?
I mean, it came to an end in 1922. Yes, yes. So that's...
1922, yes, sorry. Yes, it's a massive... it's a massive change of population of going from one place to the other, also as well as a cultural change of epic proportions. And of course, in the last 10 years, we've seen another movement of peoples across the Aegean into Greece. And I'm just, as I've been reading your book and some other recently published books about Greek history, it strikes me that influx, not just invasion, but population exchange, is the abiding hallmark of Greek history. Athens, someone new is always coming to Athens. Someone new is always coming to town. Do you feel that as well as you look over the history of Athens?
Look, certainly there are always, certainly if you look at the Macedonian period or the Roman periods, that yes, there are always, yes, new rulers appearing. But not to say that there isn't a sort of a nativist Athenian sentiment among those who are, born and bred in Athens and are protective of the place. I mean, I think, taking the things one by one, I mean, certainly, the influx of the 1920s, which I wrote about in another book, which sort of, doubled the population of Athens, of Greater Athens. It led to the emergence of, initially shanty towns almost, but then, soon became, quite poor but vigorous and lively districts of Greater Athens, consisting of, recent arrivals from what Greeks would call Asia Minor, in other words, sort of, Anatolia. It transformed the place, but in a sense, it reinforced the role of Athens as the center of Hellenism, because prior to that influx, there were people in Athens who quite seriously thought that Athens is only a temporary capital because our natural capital is Constantinople, which we will one day conquer. And it's not necessarily sort of, against the Turks. I mean, there were those who thought that, our future lies in Hellenizing the Ottoman Empire from within. And that's how we'll recreate the Byzantine Empire. That was a serious idea, in the early years of the 20th century. Now, as a result of the defeat in 1922, Athens was, for better or worse, reinforced as the hub of Hellenism. Instead of being a place where people dreamed of expanding the borders of the state to the ultimate peripheries of the Hellenic nation. On the contrary, those peripheries actually came physically into Athens and populated its... there was a great concentration of Hellenism in Athens. And as you say, almost a kind of... emerging of the ideas of Athens and Hellenism. Now... The influx of recent years has been it has been conceived differently. I mean, the most desperate end of that influx, which is boat people, that hasn't especially affected Athens as such. That's more affected the Aegean Islands. But there has been, from the mid 90s onwards, there has been an enormous influx of quite economic migrants into Athens who were not perceived by the existing population of Athens as fellow citizens or as Greeks or as even future Greeks. They were assumed to be economic migrants, who would stay and whose presence was tolerable, as long as they weren't enfranchised and as long as they didn't. But now we're dealing with sort of a second generation. So we're dealing with a multicultural reality which is something, you know, really quite new in modern Greek history, and significantly different from the 1920s migration, which was conceived ideologically as kind of bringing in our own people. And ideologically speaking, the new influx is sort of people who would still, be described as outsiders. I mean, perfectly welcome and tolerated outsiders, but nonetheless not part of the Greek family unless they can convince us otherwise. And yet there are some extraordinary stories of integration into the Greek mainstream, and I can tell you one if you give me time.
Sure, absolutely. Go ahead.
And this is a story I rejoice over. I mean, I could almost say, popular hero of the Athenians these days, I would say, is a sportsman who actually lives mostly in the United States, a basketball player who plays for the Milwaukee Bucks. His name is Giannis Antetokounmpo. He's about 7 foot tall. He grew up in a dirt poor district of Athens, Sepolia. He sold trinkets on the street as a young man, and he somehow made it to the upper echelons of the sports world. He is very much devoted to Greece and to his particular district of Athens. He speaks fluent Greek, of course, with a working class Athenian accent. He is adored by many ordinary people in Athens. And I must say he, in a sense, personifies the hope that Athens will somehow rise to the challenges of the multicultural age.